This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Since we launched the brand new Renegade University a few weeks ago, the world has changed. We have new courses, new faculty, many, many new students who are joining this new revolution in higher education. We have a new, unique educational platform that features video courses, one-on-one interaction with instructors, and a plethora of live events across the country. And right now, as part of our grand new launch, we're offering 30 to 40% off everything at the brand new Renegade University. To experience RU 2.0, go to renegadeuniversity.com. So it is Christmas Eve, in the evening even, and I am in the home of Joel Gilbert in Thousand Oaks, California, and I am really not supposed to be here, not only because it's Christmas Eve, but because you're a very bad man, apparently. I've been hearing from a lot of people that I shouldn't interview you, that I shouldn't be associated with you, that your name should not be on my show, but I'm here anyway because I think what you've done is very important, and I think you've accomplished your major objectives, and I think that if people watch the film, read the book, and take it seriously, I think much of American politics, and I mean much of American politics, because so much of American politics is based around race, would change. So thanks, Joel, for doing this, first of all.
Thanks for coming, and I'm sure the people that didn't want to have me on your show have not seen the film.
Yep.
And object to these facts coming out.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy you've come, and glad you're here.
So the film, I had told you this before we started rolling, but let me just state it for the audience. So here's my position on the work you've done on this. I believe that you've persuaded me. I think your major theses, and you make several theses in the film and the book that are all quite persuasive. You know, I wouldn't say 100% because there's no such thing to me, but I find the evidence to be, you know, this is the word that's actually appropriate this time, overwhelming. I also have some criticisms about the ways in which the film was made, the approach, certain angles you took, which might be minor, but I want to talk about that with you. But I do think that you've done something that's potentially massively important in American politics if this is taken seriously.
Well, that's why I recognized the importance of it when I got started on the road. And actually, the reason I started looking into the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case was because of Andrew Gillum. Mm-hmm. I was really amazed and shocked that this kind of far-left Tallahassee mayor kind of came out of nowhere, won the Democrat nomination, almost beat Ron DeSantis, and he had this very race-based campaign. He was talking about the Trayvon Martin case, stand your ground. He said to DeSantis, I don't think you're a racist, but the racists think you're a racist. And I think everyone has been pretty disturbed how American politics and life and culture has revolved so much around race. And it's almost as if we're living in a sermon of Obama's pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Mm. And I'm probably one of the only white guys who's listened to most of his sermons because of a movie I made about Obama's background, 2012, called Dreams from My Real Father. And this was the narrative, USA, KKK, all this nonsense. Now, I grew up in Tennessee in the 70s and 80s. Black and white kids were all friends. I had Korean kids. Bruce Orr, who's in trouble at the DOJ, was a friend of mine. Grew up with him. I never heard the N-word. if anyone ever heard that or heard somebody call someone that, they wouldn't have lasted very long. It wouldn't have been acceptable. So to this whole narrative that kind of started around this Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case, when you look back, all this racial division kind of started there. Fake news kind of started there in the modern era. I realized that they wanted us to believe that America is somehow suddenly a racist country. And particularly I saw that the Ferguson effect, Ferguson, Missouri, a hands up, don't shoot, all this stuff that caused lack of policing, 33% rise in homicides in black neighborhoods. I realized that no one has suffered more from this narrative than the black youth of America. And that's proven out since my film has been out. The people that have responded the most positively are black Americans. I had a girl email me and she said, I have a black son and I was afraid for him to grow up in America, but I watched your movie and now I realize we got played. She goes, thank you. And you can just look at the responses on Amazon, the reviews. You know, the essentially the investigation shows that the key witness for the prosecution of George Zimmerman, Rachel Gentel, the plus-sized Haitian-American girl, that she's the only reason Zimmerman got arrested, because the police had investigated and exonerated Zimmerman. Self-defense, it's not even stand your ground, it's over. And I chronicle in the film, Al Sharpton came down in the book, I go into more detail, that the Department of Justice actually sent down representatives, the CRS, Community Relations Service, allegedly to investigate, and they actually helped organize protests. Then Obama came, of course, the family attorney for the Martin family held up a digital recorder at a press conference. This is after Zimmerman's been exonerated. And he said, we found Trayvon's girlfriend just last night. Her name is Diamond Eugene. She's 16. And she was on the phone. It's puppy love. And he plays these excerpts that seem to contradict all the eyewitnesses and all the physical evidence. He says, arrest Zimmerman now. Barack Obama comes on board the next day. If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. The state of Florida is pressured into appointing a special prosecutor. They come down to Miami. They go to Diamond Eugene's house, 16 years old. I've got the address in the unredacted documents. That's her house. They're sent away to another address where a woman who works for Trayvon's mother lives. And 18-year-old Rachel Gentel appears. She says, oh, I'm Diamond Eugene. That's my nickname. And, oh, I lied about my age. When I realized there was a witness switch, and that was from looking at Trayvon's 750-page cell phone records, right. I could see that he was texting back and forth photos with Diamond Eugene, and it's not Rachel Gentel. So I said, if I can find out if there really is a Diamond Eugene, if I can find this girl, and I can get her in my movie, and I can find out why she was switched out and who knew about it, I'm going to tell this story, because it really was what divided America for no reason. I'm offended as someone that grew up with people of all races and never having a problem, never experiencing or seeing racism on the level that they say it exists. It's offensive, and I think it's harmful. It's not America. America is a very loving country and very accepting country. And even when Obama was elected, even though I didn't agree with his politics, I was proud of having a black president. Most people were. But then from 2012, relations have gone south, and it really started with this case. So that's why I thought it was such an important story to tell. And as you mentioned, I agree that it could reset history, change history. Black Lives Matter wasn't necessary. Colin Kaepernick didn't need to take a knee and quit the 49ers. All this division was unnecessary. So I think one of the main lessons of my film is brotherhood. We're all brothers, black and white. We're all brothers under this great constitution, under a country of liberty with justice for all. And that we need not be divided because of hoaxes, because of race hoaxes. And this is what one of the main messages is.
Okay. And you're also speaking to your motivation in making this film.
Absolutely.
And a lot of filmmakers would not bother with the speech that you gave, because they probably would be saying what their audience wants to hear. But I'm sure you've been getting attacked and you've been getting criticized, and there's been a lot of skepticism thrown at you about this. People calling into question your character, your credibility, and your motivation, because you are... How do you describe your politics?
Well, first of all, I'll correct you that I have had very little negative feedback.
Okay.
Very, very little.
Well, I've seen some, and I've...
It's very little.
Okay.
I mean, I have not received it. It's mostly, 99%.
Yeah.
Positive, and they say, wow, great research, you nailed it. Of course, especially the black people, they're saying, we knew, tell us something we didn't know. We knew that girl wasn't Trayvon's girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
We just didn't understand how this was used to create this political narrative to make us feel fearful that there's armed white men in the streets and police that want to shoot us because they don't like our skin tone.
Right.
So I don't think I've really had much negativity. People recognize the content. Now, there are people that haven't seen it that object to the very idea of what I call, I guess, the gospel of Trayvon, or this story that the media put out there, and the media malfeasance was really started with Attorney Benjamin Crump, that after Zimmerman was exonerated, they put out a story that Trayvon was a very small child, which they put out that photo, he's about 10 years old, and he was on a candy run delivering candy to his brother, mm-hmm. who wasn't his brother, and was attacked by Zimmerman. The guy jumped on him, Trayvon screamed for help for about a minute and shot him in cold blood. So most people kind of remember that story, and it's hard for them to give it up emotionally, because I've had some emails also from black teenagers. They say, man, we grew up on this stuff. And one guy wrote on Vimeo, he wrote a review or a comment. He said, this black guy, he said, a tough pill to swallow for those of us who took it hook, line, and sinker. Hmm. And so there's a whole narrative of Black Lives Matter where people grew up on this for a few years. So it's penetrating slowly that, you know, this was a hoax. The Hands Up, Don't Shoot was a hoax. Tawana Brawley was a hoax. 3 months ago, there was a black girl in Virginia. The media ran with this story. They said there's a black girl who's, she said three white kids cut off her dreadlocks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right. My God. It's to me. I'm like, oh, my God. That's horrible. The next day, they said Mike Pence's wife works at this school. They were so excited. The media was so happy. The third day, the mother said she made it up. So we don't need these ridiculous hoaxes. I think one of the lessons is when you hear these wild stories, be very cautious, because there's people with agendas that are pushing them.
Okay. So yeah, we talked about your motivation, and I asked you about your political identification, and you did not answer the question, which is fine.
I'd be happy to get to that.
Great. But if you had said, go screw yourself, I would have said, right on, brother, because I think that's what's used against you, right? And or when people use anything against you, that's what's used, right?
Look, I believe in America, and I don't really worry about political affiliations. I don't think I'm controversial, actually. I think all my films are kind of research. The Middle East politics, Farewell Israel, Bush Iran, the Revolt of Islam. Made a comedy on Trump called Trump, the Art of the Insult. It's a lot of fun. I don't think I'm controversial. I don't think I'm that political. I'm just laying out these stories. And people that don't like the truth or a different look at a storyline that they bought into might get bent out of shape. You know, we don't want to hear that something is different from what we believe. There are people like that, and that's fine. Some of them come around too. I get emails from them like, you know, hey, you were right. You know, usually after they take a look at the movie and they haven't seen it is when they criticize.
Right. So let's do this. Let's lay out your, what I think are your basic arguments or theses in the film and in the book. Okay.
Sure.
From maybe smaller to bigger, right? Because you make very specific claims about the case itself, and then you make very large claims about American politics from it, okay? So, number one, Trayvon Martin was, you very sympathetic to him, by the way.
Correct.
And you, in fact, end the film by saying, Trayvon Martin, I forget how you put it, but would not be happy with the way he's been used to further this hoax and this agenda, right?
Right. I say he really was, at heart, he was a good kid. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the film, I show how he was a normal kid that went in a downhill spiral, and I show why that happened and the forces at play. And I conclude the film by saying, at heart, he was a good kid. He never would have wanted people to die for a hoax in his name.
But I don't, he doesn't come across as a very good kid in the film. I'm actually persuaded, I mean, I think everybody's a good person in some ways, but I mean, he was doing a lot of very bad stuff at that time.
True.
Right?
I mean, look, Charles Manson, when he was 15, 16, was probably a good kid before
sure.
things went to hell.
Yeah.
So I got to know Trayvon in the last 8 months of his life. I probably know him better than his friends and family do.
Because you read all of his text messages.
I read 3,000 text messages, hundreds of emails. I just got to know the relationships he had with his friends, with his family, with girlfriends, with girls he was hitting on, with Diamond Eugene. So mm-hmm. I kind of got to know him. Probably known better than anybody, honestly. Hmm. And he was a normal, average kid. He was not a bad kid. What happened in his life is reflected in his last words that he told George Zimmerman, that Zimmerman revealed in my film. And by the way, Zimmerman is in the film. He did not even testify in his own trial. So you get to hear what happened blow by blow that night,
right,
direct from Zimmerman. But Zimmerman told me that Trayvon told him as he lay dying, he said, please tell Mom Alicia I'm sorry.
Right.
And that tells the whole story right there. So what happened was in November of 2011, Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin, divorced and left his stepmother, Alicia Stanley. 14 years, that's his mom. He had to go back and live with his biological mother, Sabrina Fulton. He started acting out very badly. He was very hurt. He lost his home. He lost his mom. He's like homeless now. but he's sleeping mostly at his biological mom's house. He starts getting into heavy marijuana use, dealing guns, throwing caution to the wind, fighting all the time. I could almost tell that he was trying to get kicked out of Sabrina's house so that he could go back and live with his stepmother. That seemed like what he was up to. Even Alicia Stanley told Anderson Cooper on CNN, he wanted to live with me and his father. And that's probably what was going on. He just didn't care anymore. So he didn't have a father in the home. Sabrina, every time he got suspended for fighting, she'd kick him out. He's like homeless. And he was sent away up to live in another home. So he kind of went in this terrible downhill spiral. So I am sympathetic to, you know, he was not a bad kid. And this kind of happened to him. So one of the lessons is that for black youth, it's not, the problem is not that there's armed white men in the streets hunting people with skin tones they don't like. It's that there's a lack of strong fathers in the home to give guidance. No guns, no fighting, no gangs. And Trayvon didn't have that father in the home, and it's somewhat typical. He was also a victim of this Obama administration policy about the school to prison pipeline that Parkland shooting guy, Nicholas Cruz, because he was caught a couple times by police, and each time he was suspended rather than having intervention. So you can even wonder that when this guy Jonathan Good came out of the apartment and yelled at Trayvon, stop, you know, get off of him, I'm not going to call the police. And Jonathan Good said he was punching Zimmerman MMA style. What was Trayvon thinking? He didn't stop punching. I mean, maybe he was thinking, well, I'm already suspended, they can't do anything to me, you know? Mm-hmm. So there could have been intervention even from the police, but that was also removed. So there's a lot of issues that kind of came together. That's why this doesn't happen every day, because there's a lot of mistakes and things that came together for this tragedy to happen.
Right. But you present him, and I am persuaded by this, that he, at that moment in his life, was the kind of person who could have, in an unprovoked way, attack George Zimmerman in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. He was smoking pot, a lot of pot. He'd smoking right at that time. He had more marijuana in the system than you could allow to drive in most states. Mm-hmm. At 17, he'd been heavy marijuana use.
Dealing guns.
Fighting all the time, getting into fights. His hobby was watching fights on YouTube. And he was talking to the girlfriend, Diamond Eugene. And we don't know for sure, but he could have been trying also to show off for her. So there's a lot of things that could have been going on in his head, none of them good.
Right. Well, he probably had some conflict with her at that moment, right, that day.
Oh, they were fighting and hanging up on each other all day long.
Right.
He was very distraught. She was going to clubs with other guys. He was sent 200 miles away. He was very upset. She was kind of trying to get to cut it off, but still hanging on. So there were a lot of bad things going on in his head that led to this aggression, I believe. And unfortunately, you know, Zimmerman at some point had to defend himself.
Right. Okay. So I don't know for sure, but it's highly persuasive. And I knew a fair amount of that, by the way, before the film, but you really, I think, nailed it. And I like the fact that you are sympathetic to him, that you try to, you know, you're human. You treat him as a human being who's not just a thug, but he's just a troubled kid and generally
troubled
a good kid.
It wasn't a thug. A thug is a little different thing. It's someone that's looking for fight, trying to hurt people all the time. He had different issues. That wasn't what it was about.
But he had a lot of friends who you might classify as thugs. You know, they were basically criminals dealing guns and drugs and very violent. And
look, Trayvon was becoming a one-man crime wave at that time. Let's face it. He was dealing guns, dealing drugs, smoking. He was in a downhill spiral that only started 3 months before. So it's not like he's 25 years old and he's been doing this stuff or in gang activity for years.
Right.
It's something that just recently started and unfortunately led to all these circumstances.
Okay, great. So that's thesis number one. Thesis number two, which is probably the biggest in terms of the case, and it's really what the film and the book hinge on, is that you, I think, reveal something quite astonishing, which is that the prosecution probably, almost definitely, I think, switched witnesses, invented this fake witness and coached her. And can you just lay that out for people who haven't seen the film?
Okay, sure. Well, look, part of the film, I show how Diamond Eugene, after Trayvon was shot, she's actually tweeting about the shooting. She tweets, "My eyes are heavy." She tweets, "Prayers changes things. I got hope." She starts calling her friends. She calls Trayvon back and forth. She starts praying. So she might have heard the shot. More likely, she...
So just so people... Yeah. Because 7 years ago, people might forget this.
Yeah.
So the key evidence in the case was this phone conversation allegedly between Trayvon's girlfriend and Trayvon right up until the shooting. And then, right, and then that was used later as evidence.
Well, look, the key evidence in the case was the eyewitness, Jonathan Good, that came out and saw that Trayvon was on top of Zimmerman wailing away on him. The key evidence was the location of the altercation next to Zimmerman's car.
I meant the key evidence for most Americans, right? Most Americans heard about this girlfriend and her testimony, and that's what turned it into this spectacle, right? Into a major cause celeb.
Right. So what really happened is Benjamin Crump, 3 weeks after the shooting, came up with this witness.
The lawyer for the Martin family?
Correct.
Yep.
Now, what really happened, we know from the phone records of Diamond Eugene and the tweets that she was putting out, is she was under severe pressure from Trayvon's friends, Trayvon's father and family and attorney to come and, quote, make a statement. She didn't want to say anything. She did it under coercion, under pressure. And once she did go and meet Sabrina Fulton under pressure, they asked her to come back that evening and do an on-camera interview with Matt Gutman of ABC. Mm-hmm. She refused and only did the over-the-phone interview. And in that interview, as you see in the film, she just agrees with everything Crump says. She repeats back word for word the media narrative he'd put out in the media. She says he wasn't doing nothing. He was just getting some Skittles for his little brother. She knew that was all a lie.
And she also, didn't she make a claim in that it was basically about racism?
Yeah, she said, it's racial. Mm-hmm. This is just repeating everything Crump had put in the media or even told her. So she's 16, she was under pressure, so she did what she thought she had to do. Now, a week and a half later, it worked too well. Now the police are coming to talk to her. Obama, president's on board. This little plan kind of worked out a little too well. Mm. But she didn't want to do it, so she bails out.
Okay.
And Rachel Gentel, who we find out later through my DNA test is her half-sister, of course. I don't want to give that away to everybody, but it's a pretty amazing discovery.
Yeah.
And by the way, Diamond Eugene also gives a letter to Trayvon's mother, which she signs Diamond Eugene, which also tells the same story that Crump had, you know, she was mimicking from Crump.
Concocted, you might say.
Well, she's mimicking from his story.
Yeah.
And it's signed Diamond Eugene. And of course, you watch the film, how I got the handwriting samples to find out that Rachel did not sign that as she claimed. So Rachel Gentel is substituted in. Now, we don't know exactly whose idea it was.
Is Rachel Gentel. She became famous.
Yeah.
Great. Because she was this key witness. And she had, according to you, and I believe you, basically nothing to do with Trayvon except that she was the half-sister of his girlfriend.
Right. Okay. She's about 150 pounds heavier, a year older. And
not terribly bright.
Well, she couldn't put two sentences together. She's most famous from the trial. They asked her to read the letter that Diamond Eugene had given to Trayvon's mother. And she claimed, first of all, well, that's my nickname. I mean, who has a nickname of a different name? Right. And then she also said she signed it. And they asked her to read it, and it turned out she couldn't read. She says, I can't read cursive. Now, I think she couldn't read at all. But that's what she said, and it was obviously very humiliating for her. So people remember that from the trial. But what happens is they go to, as I said earlier, they go to Diamond Eugene's house. They're sent away. Rachel Gentel appears. And actually, Trayvon's mother, Sabrina Fulton, who's now running for Miami-Dade commissioner, by the way, she's been endorsed by Hillary Clinton, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren. She calls Diamond Eugene. And Diamond Eugene tweets and says, Trayvon Martin's mom just called me. She thought I was Trayvon's girlfriend. You know, she's trying to deflect because she has a boyfriend. So obviously, Sabrina knew about this witness switch and did not blow the whistle and say, let's just tell, she should have told the prosecutor, this is not the girl I met twice. I talked to her mother. We've been talking on the phone. You need to go back to Diamond's house and get her, and let's sort out this nonsense with these young ladies, what they're trying to pull here. Right. But we don't know if Crump was in on it exactly. Diamond did call Crump 2 days earlier before Rachel showed up. I don't know what they talked about. I got the phone records. And so how could he not have known? Now, the prosecution in that interview, how could they not have known that this was fake? They had all her phone records.
Yeah.
And they asked her things like, how many times did you text with Trayvon that day? She says, one. It's really 32 times. They ask her, how old are you? She says, 18. Crump just told Matt Lauer on ABC a couple of weeks earlier that she was a 16-year-old teenager. Hmm. Her name's not Diamond Eugene. They ask her these questions. Every question they ask her, they know the answer, and she gets it wrong. And they keep asking the question to try to fit her answer. They say, did the guy get out of the car and say he was going to hit Trayvon? She says, you could say that. I mean, everything is ridiculous. Now, at the end of the interview, she actually confesses. She breaks down. Mm-hmm. And it's in the trailer. That's you amazing. Can go to the TrayvonHooks.com. Yeah. It's in the trailer.
Yes.
Six times she says, I feel guilty. I feel guilty. You say, why do you feel guilty? I know about it. What? I know about it. And they use her statements anyway, instead of arresting her for lying.
Yep.
They use her statements to arrest Zimmerman, even though the statements she makes are in contradiction to the eyewitnesses.
Right.
So I do have a theory that the, you know, why would the prosecution, they withheld the cell phone records. They lied and told the defense that Diamond was only 16, which was true. So they couldn't talk to her until just before the trial. So just before the trial at the deposition, now she's 19-year-old Rachel Gentile walks in. The defense is like, she says, well, I'm Diamond Eugene. I lied about my age. I lied about my name. And it's just incredible when you look back how they could have pulled this off. But, you know, how could the prosecution not have known? Because I had the documents for 3 months and I figured out the whole thing. Trayvon is texting photos with Diamond Eugene. It's not Rachel. How could the prosecution, FDLE, subpoena powers, how could they not have known?
Yeah.
So I think there was a political agenda at play that is a travesty of justice and led us down this path of racial division for no reason.
Yeah. So the real girlfriend who was really on the phone with Trayvon did not show up, but some her half-sister did, who knew nothing about this, and she clearly didn't know anything about it, and because she couldn't even read her own letter. And when asked questions, she knew very little, and she just seemed completely spaced out. And as you're right, it's an amazing moment in the film. She really does seem to me to admit guilt. And, you know, I ain't know nothing about this.
I know about
it. She repeats it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. So that's mind-blowing. And, you know, that's damning, and that's the central part of your film. But then you make some larger arguments.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's where you're going to get in trouble. Not with me, by the way, but with other people. One is that, and you sort of mentioned this already, that Democrats have used this and similar cases cynically, you know, basically to get votes of black people, to present themselves as the protectors of black people, perhaps, right? And I, you know, I know that other people have been critical of you for that argument. You may have played it a little strongly, but I actually think you're fundamentally right about that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. Look, the black vote was not in the tank for Obama in the middle of 2012. They had the election coming up. Everything had gotten worse in black America. Mm-hmm. 70% unemployment, black male youth in urban America. Mm. Illegals coming in, taking jobs, driving down wages. Businesses were closing up because of regulations and taxes. Everything gotten worse. So, you know, why would Obama's advisor, Al Sharpton, come down? Why would they send the DOJ down to start organizing protests? Judicial Watch pulled the documents. They were organizing protests to arrest Zimmerman without cause. Obama immediately jumped on board after they got the Diamond Eugene.
Yeah, sorry, interjection. Sure. Sorry. You're saying the Department of Justice organized protests?
Correct.
We have evidence of this?
Yes.
Okay, that's not in your film.
It's in the book.
Okay.
It's called the Community Relations Service. It's part of the DOJ, just like the FBI.
Okay.
And they went down, said, we're going to help look into this because in case it's racism. And they actually organized protests. And then Benjamin Crump, after he presented this Diamond Eugene's audio phone call at this press conference, he said, I'm not going to give this 20-minute audio tape to the Sanford police. I'm going to give it to the FBI. That's part of the DOJ, which are organizing protests. Mm. So there's no question that when you look at the what the Department of Justice was up to, that this came from above. They wanted to exacerbate race relations. J. Christian Adams wrote a book. He was at the Department of Justice. He was a holdover from the Bush administration, and he talked about how they hired 1,000 attorneys from social activist groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and La Raza just to look for these types of cases to exacerbate race relations. Now, also at the time, don't forget the backdrop, Obama was using the IRS to go after the Tea Party movement, to break up the opposition political groups. So they were using the tools of state, just like we saw 2 weeks ago with the IG report, FBI, DOJ, CIA, socialist-minded people like Obama, whose heroes are radical socialists and Trotskyites and Marxists.
We differ on that, but that's okay.
It's the playbook.
Yeah.
Socialist policies don't work. Everything gets worse economically. Government goes in to take over industries and things end up falling apart. So they have to use the tools of state to stay in power, police state. And that's what was going on. The IRS was at play. The DOJ came into play for this case. That's what they were up to in the background that continued up to the end of the Obama administration. So, yes, there was a political agenda that everyone was on board with.
Right. Yeah. Maybe this isn't important, but it's not socialism. It's progressivism. You know, you're right in the rest of your analysis, I believe. But Obama is most definitely not a socialist and never was. He's a progressive. He wants the government to control a lot of the economy and a lot of our political life and even parts of our culture. And I agree with that. But it's not socialism, but that's okay. it's neither here nor there in this case. Okay. So I do believe clearly the Democrats have, I'm actually persuaded by this. I hadn't heard this before, but that makes sense to me because they are so dependent on the black vote and they've been going after it so hard and they're so dishonest in so many ways.
Right.
I was as cynical about the Democratic Party as anybody on earth, basically, before I watched your film. And now I just think it is nothing but a party based on fraud. And I have nothing good to say about the Republicans either, just so you know. But like, I just find the Democrats, especially their recent iteration, to be astonishingly fraudulent, you know, and shamelessly and almost gleefully, you know, and it's from Gillum to Clinton to Obama again and again and again, they make up these things or they promote these things like Obama did with Trayvon Martin, which even if he was right, even if Trayvon was, ruthlessly gunned down by this white supremacist, he had no business weighing in on that case and saying Trayvon would have looked like my son. Right. Or my son would have looked like Trayvon, because the power of the presidency, you know, to shift the culture is immense. Right. And that was really a huge turning point as well. OK, so I agree with your general thrust about the Democratic Party there.
But don't forget, Black Lives Matter was hosted at the White House after that.
Sure.
I mean, this was a movement that he jumped on. And socialists have always looked at minority groups and ethnic groups to exploit them. I interviewed a former KGB agent named Konstantin Prebojinsky in one of my films, and he told me that the Communist Party viewed American blacks as the raw material for revolution.
Correct.
That they could manipulate them with these racist, race-based narratives. It's been going on since the 30s. Mm-hmm. And Obama was really one of the pioneers. He came in from New York to Chicago, worked for the Developing Communities Project in Chicago, and that was a socialist group that was trying to recruit black churches for the socialist causes. And they had not been interested because Marxism and socialism were atheists, and these were religious people. They were not interested because they were into love thy neighbor, as Christianity preaches, not this war between the classes. So Obama was a front man for white socialists in Chicago. Dom Trotter, the black assemblyman in the Illinois State Senate, accused Obama at the time of being a white man in blackface because he was such a white liberal and supported by white liberals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reflected in his presidency. Nothing got better for black Americans.
Okay. So back to the film. So, and your major arguments there. So I think certainly on the case, I think you present overwhelming evidence that Trayvon was in a state of mind and a state of his life that could certainly have led him to do something like this, to attack Zimmerman unprovoked. Evidence is overwhelming to me that they switched witnesses and perpetrated an incredible hoax. And by the way, why is the prosecution not in the film? I mean, you don't really go after, were they not willing to be interviewed, or is that what they're sort of left out of the film? You focus on Crump, Martin's family.
Well, I do ask the question several times. How could the prosecution not have known this? Mm-hmm. Is this why? I have to ask questions because I don't have smoking guns on them. Is this why they withheld so much evidence from the defense? Why did the defense have to spend 2/3 of their time in court just putting sanctions on the prosecutors for not disclosing evidence? So they have a lot of explaining to do. I mean, they're being sued by Zimmerman right now, along with the FDLE and Brittany Diamond
Eugene. For $100 million.
Everybody. Correct.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, so the key evidence that you got, right, was Trayvon's cell phone records and text messages and the content, right? I mean, it's massive trove. And
correct.
It was thousands and thousands, as you mentioned earlier, text messages and I guess emails as well, and photos that have been sent back and forth. And so what you show in the film is that he had lots and lots of girlfriends, that he was very, very popular, that a lot of girlfriends were very attractive, and he was a player, you know, as it is said, and that he was also, as we've said, you know, involved increasingly in criminal activity, and that his friends were increasingly bad guys who were dealing guns and drugs. And
they were bad news.
And involved in lots of violence, and so was Trayvon. You see a lot of interaction between Trayvon and the real Diamond, Eugene, which is highly sexual, and they're very much sort of in love in a in an odd sort of teenager way. Here's my first criticism.
Before you do that, I want to point out that not only was there a treasure trove of Trayvon's cell phone records, but Diamond Eugene's Twitter account.
Yes.
There's a whole chapter in the book called Twitter Tells All, because she tweets about 50 times a day. That was every 20 minutes that she was awake, she was tweeting something.
Yeah.
And that just revealed so much of what was really going on. And that's another treasure trove. So there's a lot of things in the movie that you just, it's amazing, including how much these teenagers put out on social media.
I was going to say, it's almost as if she didn't realize that Twitter was public.
Yeah.
Right? No, it's true. She was admitting a lot on there. This is the question I wanted to ask you on my drive down here from the Bay Area today. Who is your intended audience for this?
I think the intended audience is just America.
Really?
Sure.
All of us?
Everybody. Okay. Everybody. People take different things out of it depending on how the case may have affected you or how you might see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's reflected in some of the responses. I got a lot of positive feedback from black teenagers and black kids. They're saying, oh, man, you know, we got played. Or they say, of course, they say, tell us something we didn't know. We knew Rachel wasn't the girlfriend, but we didn't understand what happened. You know, people that are concerned about media malfeasance and fake news, they say, oh, we didn't realize it's kind of where it started. Now we know fake witnesses. I don't think there would have been a fake witness in the Kavanaugh. We had four or five women writing these crazy letters that the committee was taking seriously that turned out most of them were hoaxes. You have a fake whistleblower or a whistleblower that no one knows who he is. The media was willing to completely lie about something and run with it. So people that are concerned about fake news see how this is kind of where the modern era started. I think it's just a lesson of brotherhood, that there's people that want to divide us, politicians and the media that want to pull us apart, when our real aspirations have always been to come together as one nation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what the lesson is of the movie. And I think anyone can enjoy it.
Okay, here's a criticism I wasn't going to bring up, but I will now. You talk about America in pretty glowing terms, you know, prior to 2012, right, in terms of race relations. Do you believe that there is a reason that there was such a hysteria around Trayvon Martin beyond just cynical manipulation of people's emotions?
Look, I think there have been, if you look at one of my films called There's No Place Like Utopia, there's been where I go to progressive cities, I go to Detroit and Chicago, places where Democrats have been in control for 50, 60 years, and there is a wealth disparity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people don't realize it's caused by Democrat policies, terrible schools, terrible education, drug culture, single parenthood. So the Democrats want a racial scapegoat for this because they don't want to admit that their policies don't work.
Mm-hmm.
So they're always looking to assign these issues to racial scapegoats,
mm-hmm.
as did Trayvon's mother, Sabrina Fulton. She could have and should have supervised his suspension at home, his third suspension, and said she kicked him out. I'm sure the pain was overwhelming for her, that she knew that had she not kicked him out, this probably wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
The parents found a racial scapegoat in this. Race relations were rated by both black and white as positive, like 70% on both sides, prior to 2012. We had a black president.
Mm-hmm.
We just come so far. I think people with political agendas, people like Al Sharpton, the Democrat Party, the media that wanted this fear narrative, this race, fear-fueled race narrative to serve their ends, you know, exacerbated any old feelings or concerns about race, such that it's like the main narrative in every part of American society today, when it's totally unnecessary and it's divisive for no reason.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think there's any such thing as over-policing in black communities?
I think there's a lot of problems that happen that can be worked on and improved. I look at these as things that we can continue to improve on.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's individual incidences, probably, I think there definitely are, where people do something for racist reasons, but it's the 0.001 minority. And then you have people then exploit that for political purposes, I think has been the biggest trend since the Trayvon Martin case, since they successfully did it. If you can make up a lie called Skittles and iced tea, he was just carrying Skittles and iced tea, it's like a slogan. So if you're a radical socialist activist, why wouldn't you make up a line, hands up, don't shoot? Yeah, hands up, don't shoot. I'm the guy that helped attack the police officer after we robbed the store and he tried to surrender. And the media runs with that. So you have people that try to make racial instances where they don't exist. Or if you did have a racial incident, it's not because America's racist. It's because that person was a total idiot.
Okay.
Racism is stupid. Anybody that wants to judge somebody on their skin tone, it's the dumbest thing. There's nothing stupider. Okay. So you want to say a stupid person because one person is stupid, that the rest of us are too. That's not correct.
Okay. Do you? This is not in your film. This is not even necessarily relevant. You don't even have to answer this. But do you have an analysis of why we have 2.3 million people in prison now and half of them are black?
Oh, boy. I don't really have a fresh analysis. I know that we get back to what I said earlier about urban America.
Yeah.
In urban America, in Detroit, Chicago, you can see my film, there's no place like Utopia. There is poverty. There is drug cultures. There are single parent homes. And in those places of despair, people don't have jobs in these type of cities. So they make horrible decisions, get into drug dealing or all kind of criminal activity because maybe the welfare they go on. They don't want to be on welfare. In my movie, I talked to people in Chicago, and they were actually like the biggest conservatives you'll ever meet. They didn't want illegals coming into their neighborhoods. They didn't want marijuana legalized. They didn't. They actually wanted more police to be safe.
Yeah.
Yes. But some of them, one guy I talked to, been in prison for 9 years for armed robbery. When there's not opportunity, people make bad decisions. And I think it goes back to those policies. And we're seeing now a renaissance of the economy. I think we'll see a lot less crime and people involved in crime. So that's a little overview for you.
Cool. Good enough for me for now. Okay. So another amazing thing happens. 2 years after the Trayvon case, Ferguson happens. Mike Brown happens. Darren Wilson happens. And let me just tell you, I forgot to mention this. So when I first heard the audio recording of the actual conflict between Zimmerman and Trayvon on the grass, when you hear the screaming and the gunshot, man, was I crying. And man, did I think this was the gravest injustice I had heard of in a long, long time. And I was ripped open by it emotionally for months. Like most people, I believed it hook, line, and sinker that was Trayvon screaming.
Yeah.
After watching your film, we don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure it was Zimmerman screaming for his life, right? Okay, so 2 years after the Trayvon case, we have Ferguson. When that happened, oh boy, was I convinced that this poor kid, Mike Brown, had been gunned down by this asshole, possibly racist cop, you know? And then it turns out, from the DOJ itself, right, and its investigation and investigations by others, that no, in fact, Mike Brown was almost definitely, in fact, attacking Darren Wilson, and that Darren Wilson probably needed to shoot him to defend his own life, even though I don't like cops at all. This is probably where we disagree. I'm not a fan of cops at all. But the claim, the central claim, which became iconic, that, you know, he had his hands up and was saying, don't shoot, is almost definitely false. Okay. And yet, much of American politics has revolved around the Trayvon Martin case and the Mike Brown Ferguson case ever since, right? I mean, that has been central in American politics. And they are both almost definitely, I'm not going to say definitely, but almost definitely just made up hoaxes. That's something else.
Well,
and that's just two cases, by the way. We have others as well.
Look, guess who Michael Brown's family's attorney was? Benjamin Crump.
Oh, I didn't know
Al Sharpton, you know, they came there.
I didn't know about Crump.
Yeah,
know, wow.
They came to Ferguson for the next, they came there for the next big Trayvon hoax, as I call it. The Trayvon hoax is two things. It's the substitution of a legitimate phone witness, Brittany Diamond Eugene, for a false witness, Rachel Gentile, to get Zimmerman arrested. Trayvon hoax is also the name I give to this narrative that the media and the Democrats want people to think that there's armed white men in the streets and cops want to shoot you
because
they don't like your skin tone. So the Michael Brown case, not only was Crump and Sharpton in on it, but it has some similarities to the Trayvon case because both of them had not slept the night before, almost nothing. Both of them were high, and both of them involved an attack on someone with a gun. Trayvon didn't know the guy had a gun. How high was Michael Brown that after he'd left the scene where a gun had been discharged and an officer had been attacked, that he would actually come back and approach or try to attack a police officer? How high do you have to be on what?
Right.
So, again, also Michael Brown and Trayvon were not in their home base. They were staying somewhere else. So, you know, both those kids got into bad things and a tragedy happened, and then it was exploited for political purposes that are still with us today, that, as you say, need to rethink the politics of race when everyone was just kind of manipulated into believing these cases were something they were not.
Right. Okay. So Joel, and this, I'm just going to do what your critics are going to do to you, but let's see how it plays out. So who are you and where the hell do you come from?
Where the hell come?
What's wrong with you?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't consider myself controversial at all. You know,
sure, why not?
Well,
wait, that is silly. That is just plainly silly.
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm just presenting facts and information that to me is quite obvious. There's no grand agenda here. I'm just showing. I don't think we should be fooled by stories that cause us to divide ourselves or to be tricked politically. I don't think that's cool. I'm from East Tennessee. I grew up in East Tennessee, a small town, church on every corner. I'm Jewish, you know, a small Jewish community there. And, you know, it just doesn't seem okay that some of these things go on. So I look into them and I report on what I find, and people can judge it for themselves. So, no, I don't consider myself really controversial. People that don't like to look at the truth maybe want to make various claims or attack the credibility of the messenger. We see that a little bit. But most people that look at it, like my good friend Glenn Lurie, the professor at Brown University, looked at it with the other brilliant professor, John McWhorter. They looked at the film and the DVD and the book, and they had a great program on blogging heads, and they said, look, they came up with conclusions. They said, look, this is very meticulous. We're going to be more careful next time we hear of some egregious racial incident. We're going to be much more careful now. And they both said, look, the civil rights movement cannot be built on lies. Yeah. So that was a great program.
Glenn Lowry of Brown University and John McWhorter of Columbia University, in two separate episodes on Blogging Heads, said that you persuaded them.
Yeah, and it's not. Yeah. I'm not really making any claims or persuading them. I'm putting out the information. It's just pretty obvious. The bigger conclusions I'm making, I think, are subject to one's judgment about how this was used for political agendas. To me, it's quite obvious. Mm-hmm. I've been a filmmaker in California here. Came out here in mid-90s. Actually worked at Paramount Pictures. I was a financial analyst. And I realized I more like to tell stories and knew how to make films. Once you learn how the budgeting of a film works, you pretty much know everything. Mm-hmm. And my first film was actually on Bob Dylan. made a film with Mickey Jones, was Bob Dylan's first drummer on his electric tour in 1966. Made a film called Bob Dylan, The Home Movies, that just went worldwide. And so that's kind of how I got started. And made several films about Bob Dylan. Made two mockumentaries or comedies, but one about Paul McCartney and one about Elvis Presley. They're very funny. They did very well. And so some of the critics like to say, oh, you know, you made this film about, it's called Paul McCartney Really Is Dead. It's the urban legend. It's a comedy. So right. Sometimes they like to say, oh, you said Paul is dead, but he's alive. I said, no, it's a comedy. And I made films about the Iranian nuclear program, Atomic Jihad. A film called Farewell Israel, Bush, Iran, and the Revolt of Islam. It's a kind of a college course in Islamic history and Islamic Jewish relations, as well as films. There's No Place Like Utopia. I made a film about Donald Trump called The Art of the Insult. Very funny. Mm-hmm. Came out last year. So that's a little background. I've done a lot of writing and.
But you would place yourself. I mean, can I ask you this? Sure. Are you a Republican?
I registered as a Republican. I've been registered for a long time, but I've always been disappointed with the Republican Party. I actually registered just to vote for Trump because I thought I thought Hillary would be a. I really thought, and I still think that had Hillary won, that would have been the end of the United States as we know it. She was committed to open borders, disrespecting all the amendments. I think we would have had the economy would have gotten worse, and I just thought. For the hell of it, I'm going to go ahead and I want to be able to vote for Trump. But I've always been disappointed with the Republican Party.
In what way?
Their inability to articulate policy, their inability to fight back against some of the Obama transgressions, which included the abuse of the justice system, DOJ, a lot of things they were doing, their inability to... follow through on anything that they said they would do. I thought it was a very weak party and, you know, wasn't getting much accomplished in the opposition, which you should do. I mean, look at it. The last two speakers of the House for the Republicans, Paul Ryan and what was his name? Boehner. They both quit. fighters don't quit. Nancy Pelosi's been fighting, you know, ever she's still at it.
Okay.
So the Republicans lacked a fighting spirit for all the positions they were taking and all the money they were raising. I didn't think they were accomplishing very much.
Yeah. So you'd be called like a stalwart Republican, right? You're serious about that. And you're thinking they're not serious enough about their politics.
Well, you had them just not following through on anything they said they would do, which is pretty disappointing.
It's funny. Your criticism of the Republican Party is very similar to liberals' criticism of Obama, right? That he was weak and wasn't strong enough and didn't advocate his agenda powerfully as he should have.
Look, I know about Obama. Obama was a stealth socialist. He was not... He wasn't doing it and saying it, but he got a lot accomplished in healthcare and other areas to transform the country.
Now, even though I'm sitting in your house on Christmas Eve, you made me mad and I'm going to fight you. Okay, so listen. Do you know who Obama's mother worked for her entire life, career?
The Ford Foundation.
Yeah, do you know who funded the Ford Foundation?
Peter Geithner.
Do you know who funded the Ford Foundation?
U.S. government,
mostly. Yes, CIA. Okay, right. So she would work for the CIA her entire career. Right. His alleged Kenyan father, who you don't believe is his father, but right. The rest of us do, also was on the payroll of the CIA. The guy the political operative that he was associated with in Kenya was absolutely the CIA's guy. And so Obama comes from the CIA. I mean, how on earth would you accuse him of being a stealth socialist? He was born and raised... around the government, the foreign policy apparatus raised that boy.
Well, in fact, if you look at my 2012 film called Dreams from My Real Father, I chronicle how the man that Obama talks about having raised him in his own book, Dreams from My Father, Frank Marshall Davis, I talk about and show a mountain of evidence that Frank Marshall Davis was likely Obama's biological father. And even if you don't care about the DNA, which I don't care about either, it shows the influence that Davis had on Obama growing up. Frank Marshall Davis was one of the so-called black Bolsheviks out of Chicago that was a Communist Party USA operative under FBI surveillance for 20 years.
He was a famous communist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Obama's... how he represented himself in 2008, my father's a goat herder from Kenya, I'm going to bring us all together, I'm going to cut the deficit in half, marriage is between man and God and a woman. All his policies representing as some kind of middle-of-the-road traditional guy, when you look at his real background, that's what reflects his real policies in office. Mm-hmm. And the influence of Frank Marshall Davis, I think you can see in that film. I've even since become good friend of Obama's half-brother, who was the best man at his wedding, Malik Obama, who agrees with me that Barack is not, his dad is not probably not Obama's father, and Obama's best friend from his book, he called him Ray in Dreams from My Father. His real name is Keith Kakagawa. Unfortunately, he's still in prison here in California, but I've visited him many times. He's a good friend of mine, and he actually told me the story of how Barack found out that Davis was the father. But the political influence that that Davis had on him, I think, can't be underestimated.
Okay. So if you're right about that, and I have not examined your film, I don't know about your claims about that, so I don't know. You might be right. I'm going to go back to this criticism I tried to raise earlier about your audience, your intended audience, and you sort of said it's everybody, right? Okay. I'm just going to tell you, as a former socialist, as a former lefty, as a person who has been in that world, bi-coastal liberal left elite my entire life, I'm going to tell you your film is an absolute failure for that audience.
For everybody?
For that demographic. The people in my world.
Oh, in the socialist world.
Yeah, well, left-wing, even liberal, just from liberal to left. I am telling you, after about 10 minutes of watching that film, they're going to turn it off. And I'm not saying that's anything, you know, that's not an indictment of your film. I'm saying that it fails miserably at appealing to that. And you don't need to. I don't need you to appeal to that audience. But if that was your intention, it's a total failure because, and I'll tell you why, but go ahead.
Well, look, people on the far left are known for not wanting to receive information that might conflict with their fantasy construct of the world.
Indeed.
So they tend to reject information that might be beneficial to them to expand their worldview or to eliminate unfortunate ideas that such as communism works or something like that.
Sure.
So they don't want to hear it. So that's okay. I mean, those people over time, when they want to open up their minds, you watch the movie. But people that don't want to know anything aren't going to probably watch any message or movie they'll just stick to MSNBC.
Mm-hmm. You know what I hate more than anything, possibly, is when I'm in a political argument with someone or an intellectual argument with someone, and they sort of stop the argument and they just say, "I don't like your tone. Your tone is the problem here." Okay, I hate that more than anything. Now, hold on, I'm about to do that to you.
You like my tone?
I don't care about your tone. What I'm saying is, because I care about the content mostly, yeah. I'm saying the tone of the film is going to turn off anybody from Democrat to communist.
You're the tone that it's it has some music and some fun parts as well as serious parts. What is it about the tone that you find some people other than yourself might be concerned with?
Let me just repeat that I don't care, but I'm just telling you a lot of people will. So there's like a lightheartedness, which is fine in itself, I guess, although it is about a murder case. So I'm not so sure about that choice either, but there is a lightheartedness. You are the protagonist in the film, which is also fine. You're sort of the main character in a way, right? It follows you as you go through this case and examine the case. Here's where I think you're just going to get slaughtered by anybody from the left at all. And I mean, liberals to the left. It is in your sort of portrayal and discussion of and sort of lighthearted quote study of what you call urban culture, which is really just black culture, in particular sort of black southeastern urban culture, right? You pull out the Urban Dictionary, you know, and you do this whole scene where you like try to learn sort of urban slang, black slang, so that you can understand and translate the text between Trayvon and all of his friends, which you had to do, because I mean the texts are full of slang that a lot of people wouldn't know unless you're from that world. So I get that, but it's just I hate to do this to you because I hate it when people do this to me, and it's sort of unfair and it sort of detracts from
the
big arguments. But it's actually a reason I'm a little bit annoyed with you because. The content, the arguments are so powerful, as I said, and so important, I'm afraid that this sort of extraneous stuff is going to get it tossed into the wastebin.
Okay, well, let me comment. First of all, the good news is the movie's been out since I came to the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. in mid-September. It's 3 months. And so far, I haven't had zero bad feedback about your concern that my helping us to understand the text messages and some of the lighter moments somehow make it problematic for the overall message. I haven't heard that. Yeah. Most people have said, you know, it was such a serious subject and you at least were able to make it entertaining. Mm-hmm. I'm a film producer. Now, everybody is a producer, even though I haven't made films. But I know how to tell a story mm-hmm. and keep it interesting. And it's an emotional journey. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I take you on the journalistic journey of discovery, where I look into each thing and it leads me to the next thing. You're on this James Bond type of, you know, investigation with me. We go to Miami. We go to Tallahassee. We go talk to the voodoo priest. I mean, but so it's a journalistic journey, mm-hmm. but it's also an emotional journey. And I know how to create a film that is of interest, that will keep people interested and keep the emotional journey going. So that's some of the people who don't understand filmmaking or understand my style might not even realize it. When you go back and watch it a second, third time, there's only so much PowerPoint information you can get in a 5 or 10 minute period before you have an emotional mental break for a little music, a little travel, and then you go back to the intensity. Mm-hmm. So this is my skill as a filmmaker that people, I think, are buying into and successfully say, it was serious, I was shocked, I cried, I was elated, I enjoyed the music, I laughed, and that's what makes a great movie. So I do stand by the style. I think it works quite well. And sometimes people express concerns like yourself. You say, I loved it, but I'm afraid someone else might not like this part of it. And it really hasn't bared out.
Okay. All right. Let me be a little bit more specific. So it's not so much that there's lightheartedness and even comedic moments in it. It's that at times, many times, I think you are gratuitously making fun of elements of that culture, number one, and in particular of the people in the case. Now, the people in the case, I believe, are deserving of all kinds of condemnation, if any of this is true. I mean, this is basically a pack of liars, you know. But you spend quite a bit of time basically making fun of them, you know, and you'd go through the whole thing about sort of shaming Diamond by buying her the Scales of Justice statuette, right? And she doesn't know what that means. And it's sort of... And, it's going to, I think some people will see that. And again, I don't really care that much about this, but it's just, I wonder why you made those choices. If you were trying to appeal to 350 million Americans.
Yeah. Look, I think some of those things, like for instance, that's irony. Irony is a part of William Defoe, irony. So of course you're talking about the scene where I go to meet Diamond Eugene for the first time, and she's a criminal justice major of all things, and I decide to pile on the irony. I bring her a statue of Lady Justice as a gift. Now, I didn't know that she wouldn't recognize it. I said, I brought you a gift, Christmas gift, since you're a criminal justice major. I thought she would say, oh, great, I appreciate it. I'm going to put it on my desk when I become a lawyer. But she didn't recognize it. So when you make a film, and this is reality, you go with the flow. She didn't recognize it. So I said, well, she didn't recognize it. So, and I don't think I'm making fun of anything. I have not had that feedback. I think people kind of appreciate the light moments. I think we laugh along with some of the things. And I think I'm very sensitive. Even Diamond Eugene, who was Strayvon's girlfriend, and a lot of, you wouldn't be happy with her if you watch the movie or you know some of the things she was involved in. And even at the end of the movie, I'm very sympathetic toward her. I say that, look, she was 16. She was under tremendous pressure to tell a story.
True.
And I had talked to the voodoo priest who said that when I do find her, that she was going to have a bad heart, that she was no good. Mm-hmm. And I said, Diamond did have a good heart. The voodoo priest was wrong. Mm. I think I'm very sympathetic to Trayvon. He was not a thug.
Yes.
Even some of the other characters. So I think I put the context in there, and I would just disagree that I'm making fun of anybody. There are some lighter moments where we all kind of, and I think people that even look at some of the urban English, it's fun. You got to have fun no matter how serious this is, or you're not going to watch the movie. So I would just, I can happily report to you, I have not had complaints or feedback that this is making fun of anybody. I think they're actually appreciative. You're very sensitive. It became comedic in some places despite the seriousness, and I think I handled it well. And I most of the times I look back at one of my films and I say, damn it, I wish I had done this or that, and there's nothing I would have changed.
Okay. Audience, watch the film and let us know on Twitter. Tweet at us and tell us what you think, whether I'm right or Joel's right about this. Second criticism, I think this is the second one, maybe it's the third one. And I don't know, I really am conflicted on this. I'm really glad you did this because it's the only way we would have found this out. It was a little bit, I think Glenn Lowry might have even called it sleazy, or Don McWhorter, one of them I think called it sleazy. I wouldn't go that far. But you tricked Diamond Eugene into basically giving up the goods with a very elaborate hoax of your own. You pretended to be her best customer, and you spent quite a lot of money buying her. She's a online fashion designer. She sells clothes, sort of sexy clothes online, and she's the main model for it. And you bought a bunch of her clothes so that you could get her to meet with you. And so that she was sympathetic to you and would be friendly toward you, right? I'm glad you did it, because now I know that there was a fake going on here. But in terms of journalistic standards, that's pushing things. And if at the Columbia Journalism School, you probably would have been frowned upon.
I would disagree with that. The way the film went, when I finally identified Diamond Eugene, which took a while, I had to go to Miami and get yearbooks and do quite a bit of research when I identified her. And one of my original goals was to try to meet her. And I set up a meeting with her. I bought most of her entire inventory of her online boutique of these sexy clothes that she put online. And one of the options was you can pick them up in Tallahassee. You could pick them up instead of having them mailed. So I actually called her up, and right away I could tell her voice sounded just like the voice on the tape with Crump, and talked to her, and she offered to let me pick them up. So I went and picked them up. The main goal really at that time of point in the investigation was to get handwriting samples, because there was a very important letter that Trayvon's mother had hidden from the prosecution and the defense right up until before the trial. Why would she hide that letter? And that was the one that was signed Diamond Eugene, and Rachel claimed that her nickname was Diamond Eugene. So I wanted to get handwriting samples for this handwriting expert here in Sherman Oaks, California, named Bart Baggett. So I thought, this is the number one goal, is to get a handwriting sample. I had one sample from a traffic ticket that I got that she had online of her signature, but I needed more to see who wrote the letter. Mm-hmm. So I think I handled it in a pretty kind and professional way. I met her in the hotel lobby and gave her a Christmas gift, as you mentioned, the statue of Lady Justice.
Making fun of her.
No. We chit-chatted. I actually gave her some extra money to sign Christmas cards. Gave her an extra $100. Could you sign some cards for me? She was happy to do it. And it was very respectful. And I ended up saying, I like her. She's not bad. She's a good person. She must have, that helped me to develop my my conclusions about her. Because when you see what she was up to with Trayvon, and you know, did she suborn perjury and get Rachel to pretend to be her? I mean, there's a lot of nefarious stuff. So when I met her in person, that kind of softened it up. I said, you know what? She is a good person. She's 23. She's a criminal justice major. She was involved in some stuff years ago. She should have come forward. She should still come forward and tell what really happened, and let's relieve all this racial nonsense by telling the truth.
Right.
I thought I handled it respectfully, and I bought the clothes like any customer would. And I concluded that she was a good person, and I put that in the film. And so I would think most people say you handled that really, really nicely, and you're really nice to her. And you know, you did buy her entire inventory.
Yeah. Can you say how much you spent?
It was around $500. I tried to give it away to Goodwill, but they wouldn't take it.
Really?
They said it was too provocative, the clothing.
Right. Yeah. She's a very sexy young woman.
Yeah, you can see why Trayvon was attracted to her.
And her clothes are very sexy. Yeah. Okay, we'll leave it at that. Now, you don't confront her, and I don't think you should have. I think it was tactically wise. And so she doesn't actually admit to anything on camera, but you do totally establish that she is the real Diamond and that Rachel Gentel is not at all.
Correct.
They're completely different people, except that they're half-sisters. So that's the key thing in there. Has Diamond responded at all? Have you heard from her since this?
I have not. And since, you know, George Zimmerman made big headlines worldwide filing a lawsuit for $100 million based on all the fraud that I think I revealed in the film, since that time, she shut down her social media.
Mm.
And she's a defendant in the lawsuit. So I don't think she'll be probably saying anything. Some of the responses to the lawsuit were somewhat interesting. Benjamin Crump, the family attorney who's being sued as well. By the way, he has a new book out called Open Season Legalized Genocide of Colored People. I mean, who uses colored people? That's like 50s or something. So he's out there promoting what I call the Trayvon hoax to this day. So he responded and said, oh, this lawsuit is asinine and Zimmerman's just trying to get attention. You know, he didn't address the substance. And Ron Vereen is Rachel's attorney. He's even in the movie. He talks about how she got PTSD from this ordeal, which you can imagine. I think she gained another 100 pounds after this. You can imagine all her disabilities on display. And I talk about at the end of the film how cruel it was for those who knew she had these disabilities to allow her to testify when they knew she was not the girlfriend, how cruel that was. But his statement was to the press was, Rachel's relationship with Trayvon is whatever she says it is. That was just like more of like, she can make up whatever she wants, you know? So, but no, I haven't heard from Brittany Diamond Eugene. And I did find her in person very likable and to be a good person. And I hope she will come forward and tell what really happened.
What do you suspect really happened?
Suspect what happened that night? I think, look, Zimmerman.
No. Sorry. I mean, that's clear about like who put the hoax together and how and why and what do you think? Because you can't prove it exactly, but what do you think from the evidence that you've found?
Look, there's a couple things I cover in the book. I mean, Brittany Diamond Eugene had a boyfriend of 7 months when she was dating Trayvon.
Jeff
Wattler. So to what extent and where it works in that the boyfriend did find out about it after Brittany's voice went out on the airwaves, Brittany Diamond Eugene. So he found out about it a few days later, and that's chronicled in the Twitter and everything that I kind of reconstructed day by day.
So there's a jealousy. There's a triangle here, right? So she's dating Trayvon and Jeff sort of simultaneously, right?
Yeah. What happens is Jeff has two jobs. He's too busy. Right. Sometimes she doesn't see him for 2 weeks. She's tweeting about this. She says, I'm going to stop getting mad and get even. She tweets the whole thing. It's just unbelievable. And so once the boyfriend finds out, you have to wonder, did she then tell her boyfriend, well, no, it's my half-sister Rachel, that's Trayvon's girlfriend, not me. Maybe that's where it started, but there's no question that the adults, the lawyers, must have known this because, you know, Brittany Diamond Eugene met Trayvon's mother twice in person. Sabrina Fulton told the police that she drove Diamond home to her house on Flamingo Drive. And the ridiculous thing is that Rachel Gentel's mother was in Haiti the whole time. She was in Haiti. I actually called Rachel's mother named Marie Eugene. I called her up Because Rachel had said during the deposition, she said her mother cleans houses. So I called up Marie Eugene to ask about her house cleaning service, and Marie Eugene did not speak a word of English. Hmm. She only spoke Creole. Hmm. I kept talking to her in English. She answered in French. So Sabrina Fulton tells the police, I went and met and talked to Diamond's mother. Benjamin Crump says, I talked to her mother. The mother's in Haiti and doesn't speak a word of English. So a lot of people knew about this and went with it for this agenda. Now, who concocted it? Who went along? I mean, I'd love to see that get sorted out in Zimmerman's lawsuit. We don't know everything.
What do you think was the original motivation, though? I mean, obviously the Democrats weren't involved yet, right? This was a hoax perpetrated by the family and Crump.
Look, they wanted someone to incriminate Zimmerman. Okay, they were pressuring Brittany Diamond Eugene for weeks.
But why? I mean, Trayvon's dead. They're not going to get anything from it.
Well, the first thing they would get, which Crump had been involved in before, was suing an entity like the Homeowners Association.
Okay,
I'm sure initially they weren't thinking, Crump and Tracy Martin were not thinking, we want to get Democrats elected. They were looking to get...
Good, I'm glad you said that, because a lot of people think... No. I mean, I think that you play the Democrat card a little too hard in the film, but that's good to hear that you think the original motivation was not that. Yeah.
Well, look, the original motivation. Look, Sabrina Fulton was dragged out to the Democrat convention in 2016. She's been going around the country to this day. She does these lectures at universities. She says, people hate you so much because of the color of your skin. They want to shoot you. They want to kill you. You better vote Democrat. Your life depends on it. So she got sucked into this too. Mm. And so it's very political. Mm. But initially they were looking for an arrest. Crump had been involved. If you get an arrest, you can sue this homeowners association or the insurance company. They ended up getting a $2 million settlement.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now, Sabrina Fulton also, 2 weeks after Trayvon's death, went and got a trademark, I am Trayvon. You know? Mm. So when she, and I show this in the film, that when she realized the witness was fake, when Rachel shows up instead of Diamond, she had a big dilemma. In the book, I call it Sabrina's Diamond Dilemma, that the president had rallied to her side. People had signed petitions and marched. And if she came forward and put a stop to this, her I Am Trayvon trademark would be worthless. Their settlement with the Homeowners Association might not go through. Worst of all, the name Trayvon Martin would be associated with just another Al Sharpton race hoax. Mm-hmm. So she chose to say nothing. And poor Rachel did that first interview, and she's like, I ain't know about it. I ain't know about it. And they proceeded anyway. Mm-hmm. So there was agendas that developed. And up from the DOJ and Obama administration, Sharpton, they saw the potential in this to divide the country and get out the black vote. That's what I think.
I agree with that part. I'm just getting at the original part. And this is, I'm not disagreeing with you here. I'm just getting at this Benjamin Crump character. And I tend not to attack people like this, but you know, he's a bad hoaxer. I mean, he is he's like Al Sharpton on steroids almost.
He's a wannabe Al Sharpton. That's his hero.
Yeah.
At one of the rallies, it's in the film, he actually tells the crowd, Al Sharpton's right there. He says, we called up to New York City and we got somebody with a track record.
Mm-hmm. Well, Al Sharpton. Track record.
Yeah.
What kind of track record?
Tawana Brawley race hoax.
Oh, good God.
Crown Heights riots, 1991.
Sure.
Freddie's Fashion Mart massacre, 1995. That's the guy, that's the track record he was looking for. And to this day, he's running around with his book talking about the legalized genocide of colored people.
Yep.
Like Al Sharpton, he's built his career on a race hoax.
Okay. Do you know his background at all? Anything about him?
I think he's in North Carolina. Haven't researched him too much, but anyone can look him up. Now, he actually started a national law firm where he's, every time somebody now has any problem that might have to do with race, they call him up and he tries to make it into a racial issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's been pretty successful at it. I don't think he has a following like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have people that are emotionally loyal and tied to them. Crump has zero following. Mm-hmm. He has nobody that, you know, even his book is not selling. So he's a different kind of dude. I think he's a wannabe. He started a film production company.
Mm-hmm.
He actually is producing a series called Evidence of Innocence, of all things. You know, George Zimmerman could be on the show.
Whew. Okay, Zimmerman. Okay, you start the film with Zimmerman. Is this the only interview that we said where he lays out, where he talks about the night itself of the shooting?
Yeah, he did not testify in his own trial,
right?
So he has not really gone into this detail, telling the story. Of course, that Trayvon said, "Tell Mom Alicia I'm sorry." So this film really, he's revealing, I think, blow by blow, everything that you've never heard before.
Yeah, and you portray him very sympathetically. Again, I don't know or necessarily care, but you know, he's been excoriated for all kinds of things that he's done over the last few years. And he actually admits to, it's interesting in the film, at one point he admits to, right after the trial, to sort of playing up the bad boy, the bad man character, right? Which I thought, you know, it was nice that he did that. He was honest about it. I can't remember exactly what he did, but what do you think of that?
Well, look, this guy got severe PTSD. He still has it. I mean, look at his world. He was an Obama supporter, social activist, Hispanic guy, first language is Spanish. He talked about how he was mentoring black kids whose parents were in prison. This guy's a Sherman Ware case. He helped to get justice for a black homeless man that was attacked by a police officer's son. So this guy, he believed in the justice system. He thought it would protect him. Instead, it turned against him, including the president of the United States. So this was devastating. They accused him of being a racist and a murderer and a bigot, when really nothing of that nature happened. So it was just devastating for him. Imagine coming out of this, having been exonerated by the police, and then this entire country comes against you. So he had a severe PTSD, and he talks about acting out. He said, if they're going to call me this jerk and racist and bigot, I'm going to show them that I could be. I mean, it's just a stupid decision. So he was acting out, got into trouble, and he told him it took him a few years to work his way through it and get back to being the person he was. So anybody can see the film and, you know, judge it yourselves. And I tell everyone to start with the trailer at, you know, thetrayvonhoax.com.
Yeah, everyone should absolutely watch this movie. And I'm very curious what the reaction of my audience will be to this. I wonder how much they're going to agree with me on my criticisms. And I wonder how much they're going to be persuaded by it. This is not your fault at all. It's a very tricky story to tell. It's very complicated. And it took me, you know, you have to think through sort of the whole, especially the witness fakery, you know, the switcheroo that they did. You know, that's also a problem. You have to sort of watch the film slowly and carefully. You might have to rewind it, in fact, because it is very complicated and there's all these sort of subterranean machinations going on, right? But that must have been difficult for you.
Well, look, most people, it's laid out chronologically. You kind of come along on this journey with me. But actually, all of my films, I've never really talked to anybody that said they only watched it once, because there's so much information.
Yeah.
Any of my films. And if you look away for 5 seconds, you miss something. So people generally watch it 2-3 times and you get something else out of it each time. Yeah. So I do recommend that. It is that interesting. Look, my head's still spinning. I worked on this. I produced it. I'm in it. And I still can't believe that they got pulled off this. I mean, it's just, you just can't believe what they did and how it affected the country so badly.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you in general about that. Yeah. What do you think about, so we have clear hoaxes, probable hoaxes, I would say. Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, the Duke lacrosse case, we haven't mentioned that.
Jussie Smollett,
very, well, at least that didn't last very long, and I was exposed pretty early on. Maybe that's, you know, part of your influence. I don't know, who knows. But then there are cases like Eric Garner, you know, what do you think about that?
Look, when people don't cooperate with the police, when police say, okay, you're committing a crime, or someone especially who's on drugs, and police get involved and saying, okay, you got to come along with us, and people don't cooperate, police have all these criteria that they're supposed to do. I mean, that's one of the most tragic things I've seen, that this guy was like selling cigarettes or something.
Yep.
If the police say, you know, come along, don't do this, you got to go along and then tell it to the judge. And you get released. He would have been out in an hour. So unfortunately, you get people that are mistrustful of police or high, and they do things and the police react badly. So there are tragic individual incidences. That idiot woman that was drunk in Texas and walked into the wrong apartment and shot the guy.
Right.
I mean, incredible tragedy.
The cop, the Dallas cop, the female cop. Black man.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, how tragic and incredible and stupid and angry that this would happen. But in a country of 320 million people with 100,000 arrests, whatever, per day, there are going to be individuals who make stupid decisions. It could be an individual. Eric Garner should have just gone along. You know, look, even in the Zimmerman incident, it wasn't inevitable. Trayvon, when he saw Zimmerman slow down and stop, he actually approaches Zimmerman's car and circles his car. Now, Zimmerman, had he just simply rolled down the window and said, excuse me, sir, we have some robberies in the neighborhood. Do you live here? It wouldn't have happened. Now, later, when Zimmerman got out of his car, was going back to his car, Trayvon could have cursed him out, flipped a bird at him, shoved him, a lot of things he could have done, but he attacked him viciously. So that's a stupid decision. So we have individuals who do stupid things that are on drugs or don't cooperate, and then it turns into a terrible incident. So that's how I look at these things. And I don't think they should be exploited by politicians or the media to pull us apart and tell people that everything is racist. I think that's the my overall comment, that you're going to have incidences. Sometimes someone harbors a racist idea in a situation, and that person is stupid, you know. But that doesn't mean the rest of us are stupid.
Now, the Trayvon Martin case, I think, was the first, the last, and the only case like these that did not involve a cop. It's interesting, right?
What they did is they kind of made something that didn't exist. The media, that Zimmerman is a vigilante, a wannabe cop, a self-appointed watchman on patrol. None of that was true. He was actually driving to Target, and he was told, as he talks about in the film, that the police had told the neighborhood watch, if you see anybody looks suspicious, doesn't belong, call the non-emergency number. He said he saw Trayvon was just standing out in the rain, making any attempt to get out of the rain. They had some robberies, so he said he had done that before, and so had other people. And that's where things just kind of kept going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So let me throw some structural arguments at you, because, you know, I'm not sure the film does that, and that's fine. You don't need to. So people might say with Eric Garner, and I know this is not what your film's about, but it's certainly relevant, right? It's connected to this. They would say that the law that compelled that officer to put the chokehold on Eric Garner was a very, very bad law, which was that you're not allowed to sell loose cigarettes on the streets of New York City, which is ridiculous, right? Well, at least many of us would think. I mean, would you agree with that? In other words, so when I ask you about Eric Garner, your answer is people should comply with the law, with the police officers, and then take it up with a judge. Now, I think that is wise. That's what I would tell my son. That's what I would tell my son or my friend or anybody, right? Personally, individually, I agree with you. That's just to save their lives, right? But then is that all we want to say? Because you and I are political people in the media making, you know, journalism, and we're making statements about politics. And you're making grand statements about politics, as you should. And I agree with the general thrust. But don't you want to say something about the laws that put police in contact with people at such a high rate in this country?
Yeah, let's go back to the Eric Garner thing.
Sure.
There are very strict laws about cigarette sales and cigarette distribution, first of all. There are strict laws that protect merchants as well, that they don't allow individuals to panhandle or sell items in front of stores. Those are existing laws.
Yep.
I think Eric Garner was doing both.
Mm-hmm.
Police are called, and the guy's a lot bigger than the police.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone like that refuses to cooperate, that's when bad things can happen. Now, I'm not familiar with this chokehold thing, but generally police, I think, are trained that if someone won't cooperate and once you've decided to make an arrest, you need to do it quickly and forcefully and not allow yourself to be in danger, especially if they're a lot bigger than you. So that is just a terrible thing. I still feel, when I see that video, it's heartbreaking.
Okay.
But
you think it was basically he made a bad decision, Garner.
Well, I'd say there's...
Not the city hall.
Look,
the city hall made the law,
there's
right?
Several things that lead to it. You've got strict laws about not distributing, about cigarette distribution. You've got laws that protect merchants from people selling products in front of their stores on the sidewalk. You've got laws about cooperating with police if you're told to stand down and come with them. When all of those laws come together and someone won't cooperate, this tragedy, it doesn't happen every day. It's very rare. And this was tragic. This guy, they because he was so big, I guess the police chose a certain level of force that ended up choking the guy. I think it's terrible. Whatever, I would be in favor of anything they can do to make sure something like that doesn't happen again.
Wait a second, Joel. Wait, you're a Republican. You're a stalwart Republican. So
I'm not necessarily a Republican.
Hang on a second. Yeah, you are. You admitted to it and got you on tape saying it.
Okay.
So this was
not
a law.
Stalwart.
I know your movie's not about this, but it is connected. So this was a law that was put in effect by a very progressive city council, right? The New York City.
Which law?
The loose cigarettes that got Eric Garner killed,
I'm not familiar with it, but
okay, right. But you know it's the New York City law, right? It's a very progressive town, right? Famously, right? So it's a nanny state kind of law. It's like it's the government getting very involved in the economy as well. I mean, these are not Republican positions. I would think that you would be critical of laws like that.
I'm familiar with several laws, as I mentioned. They don't allow people to sell products in front of stores. That's one law.
Okay.
And the cigarette, this single cigarette distribution, there's strict laws all over the country about how cigarettes can be sold. Then there's laws about what you're supposed to do if the police ask you to come along.
Mm-hmm.
All of those came together in that tragedy.
Okay. All right. I'll leave that at that. One last thing. So the Trayvon's world, and I think you do a really good job in many cases, I think, or in general, I would say, of showing us the world he was inhabiting and people who were around him. And a lot of the people were very close to him, including his father, who I guess was a Crip at some point. I'm not totally convinced by the film, but I'm pretty convinced by it. Go on.
What's interesting, in the book, you'll see that Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin, was a drug courier. He flew in $1 million worth of cocaine from LaGuardia into St. Louis and was arrested.
And this, of course, is public record. So, this is public, true.
Public records, right. In the film. He actually gets sentenced to 6 years in prison by Rush Limbaugh's uncle.
I didn't know.
Stephen Limbaugh was a judge.
That.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a little trivia there.
Wow.
Trayvon's world without a father. I even talk in the film about how it's kind of a teachable moment. At the end of the film, I show some of the deposition excerpts of Tracy Martin, Trayvon's father, and you have Don West, the attorney, asking Tracy Martin, says, "Did you know that his Twitter handle was a gang name? No, I did not. Did you know he was skipping school a lot? No, I did not. Did you know he was smoking pot? No, I did not. Were you invited to any parent-teacher conferences? I was, but I didn't attend." On and on. The guy, he doesn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
Clueless. He doesn't even know he's about to be expelled. Doesn't know he was kicked out by Sabrina. Sabrina, the same thing. She says, no, he wasn't dealing guns. He didn't smoke pot. He didn't have a girlfriend. So the parents are like clueless, and Trayvon is almost like homeless. You know, those are some of the world. And a lot of his friends lived in a similar type of world, and that's why they gravitated to each other in these gang type of activities.
Yeah, so Tracy, you say, and you show, I think, that he had a Crips tattoo on his neck.
Yeah, he did. C-A-T, Crippin' All the Time.
Crippin' All the Time, which he got, which you say he got covered by another tattoo of
praying
hands.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can't verify this, but you know, it looks right to me. So we have fathers involved in gangs and drug dealing, right? That's what puts him in prison, and then a lot of Trayvon, maybe all of Trayvon's friends or his closest friends, are also involved in drug dealing and guns, which go together. Okay, now the reason that guns and drugs often go together is that drugs are illegal in this country, right? So let me just ask you this. Are you in favor of the prohibition on drugs?
A prohibition on drugs?
Do
I believe in legalizing drugs?
Correct.
I don't think it's a good idea. Don't think it's a good idea. I know there have been certain studies. I think Portugal or Spain.
Portugal.
If you legalize drugs, the drug dealers go away. And mm-hmm. I don't know enough about that. I think drug use, particularly among teenagers, smoking pot every day like Trayvon was, it can have a bad effect on the development of the mind on many issues. I know that when I went to my 10-year high school reunion, everybody that was smoking pot in high school had not done anything since high school. They were still like doing nothing.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know? And I remember thinking, there's a connection.
Okay. So I think, and I guess you disagree with me, but I think that the Trayvon Martin case would have been less likely to have happened if drugs were legal in this country, because he would have been less likely to have come from that environment. The gangs that you talk about in Miami, which are horrible, like the notorious Haitian gang?
The Zopound, very violent. I mean, part of the movie, I'd go into Little Haiti, and I learned a lot about the Haitian subculture, and the violent Haitian gangs that were there in the 90s that were causing so much mayhem, they actually got busted by the FBI and they moved into nonviolent crime like identity theft and identity fraud. Miami is the biggest center in the United States for credit card fraud.
Huh.
And so changing identities was kind of an unscrupulous subspecialty in the Haitian culture.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it might not have been a big deal for Diamond to ask her half-sister to pretend to be her.
Right.
They were switching identities all the time.
Okay. Yeah. All right. The Zopound wouldn't exist if drugs were legal, because that's how they started. They started making their money by dealing drugs, as did the Crips and the Bloods and all the gangs. Yeah. But Joel, listen, you know, we can disagree on these things and that's fine. And I'm not mad at you at all. I just wanted to raise them with you to make you think about them. But
I feel like we agreed on everything. What are you talking about?
And the movie's perfect. No, the movie, I think, is not perfect, but I think the movie is extremely important and persuasive, and I think it is generally a great success.
And I
congratulate you, and I thank you for making it. I thank you for the courage in making it, and the book I keep forgetting to mention, I'm sorry, yes, with the same name, The Trayvon Hoax. And I thank you for bringing me to your house on Christmas Eve.
Okay, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Go to the TrayvonHoax.com.
TrayvonHoax.com. Thanks, Joel. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. Thanks for listening.